This is an ABC podcast.
Well, hello. With the funereal formalities over for now, you're on Late Night Live, and I'm Kylie Morris, standing in for Philip Adams. Although, let's face it, you can't really stand in for Philip. I'm keeping the seat warm, at least, for the next few episodes. It's a cracker of a program, and we're very glad to have your company. Russia is on the menu, specifically where next for Vladimir Putin's special operation in Ukraine, so-called. The Russians, you might be aware, have had a bad September already after a successful Ukrainian counteroffensive. Propagandists for Putin's war are starting openly to express their frustrations on state TV, no less. And Putin's had a telling off from China and India. What's more, the war is now creeping ever closer to Russia's own borders. It's a twist few had predicted with any confidence. How will Moscow react? We'll join, wait for it, a fairy tale ring where, yes, good always triumphs evil, and meet two members of a magical society discovering and sharing the secrets of an age-old form of story. But first, I'm afraid Laura Tingle is on the sick list, so Crikey's Bernard Keane will be talking us through what's happening and also what's not happening in Canberra with Parliament in recess on account of the Queen's death. Bernard, I know, I can just feel how much you've been enjoying this coverage of the pomp, the wonder in London.
Well, I confess I haven't been a big fan of the coverage since Her Majesty passed away, but I did watch the funeral this evening and the pomp and ceremony associated with that with a great deal of interest, I confess. I'm a student of British history, and I think for people who aren't so familiar with British history, it really must be a case of there's that old expression about the past being another country and they do things differently there. I think moments like these really do demonstrate the extent to which Britain is a very, very different country to Australia. And I think what we saw this evening in terms of the rituals, the religiosity of this was the death not merely of a monarch but of the head of the Church of England. It was a very Anglican service. I really think, and the order of proceedings, the processions, the role of various orders of the British aristocracy really did serve to demonstrate that Britain is a fundamentally different country to Australia, which has its own stratification, has its own hierarchy, of course, but nothing like the rigidity and the historical rigidity of the United Kingdom that was on display this evening.
Bernard, I wonder, it's not specifically, though, Britain. I suppose my sense was that this wasn't about Britain, this is about the crown and this pomp, this ceremony, the costumes, the music, etc. It's about projecting, it's theatre, about projecting the power of the crown, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's crucial to maintaining the status of the royal family and of the established order that you have this immensely sort of ritualized process of transitioning from one monarch to the other. I mean, a lot of these things, well, you know, if you've studied British history, as some of us have, you're acutely aware of the fact that the processes, the titles, the political structure, the names of things are the same now as they were in the 16th and 17th century in a way that, you know, obviously we can't grasp in Australia because we've, you know, what links with our past that we have here we've turned our backs on. We've sort of dissociated ourselves with the Indigenous history that we've dispossessed this continent of. But in the case of the UK, it's we really are talking about rituals that have served the monarchy and the establishment for centuries in terms of projecting power. I mean, recently I've been reading the diaries of Chips Channon, the mid-20th century diarist and conservative MP who lived through things like the death of George V and his funeral, and obviously the abdication, the death of the Duke of Kent during the Second World War. And to read his accounts of the memorial services and the great ceremonial of that period, is very similar to reading about the reading the diaries and the memoirs of someone like Saint-Simon from early 18th century France. I mean, we're talking about rituals that haven't changed, and snobberies and social stratification that hasn't changed for a very long time and is deeply embedded in a way that I think most Australians really, I suspect, don't fully grasp.
I mean, you're describing it as a very kind of foreign experience for most Australians observing it from here, but it's also been an opportunity, hasn't it, for Australia to strongly demonstrate its alignment with the UK, even though this might not be a ceremony that we'd be capable of or necessarily want. But what does it say about how we as Australians still view our place in the world, our connectedness to that tradition?
Well, I think there's kind of a couple of competing narratives here. I mean, the official narrative, and one that's been advanced by the government, for example, and the political class, apart from minor parties like the Greens, and certainly by the national broadcast, the ABC as well, and much of the media is if you like a kind of a loyalist one. It's a narrative that has embraced the concept of the Queen as the Queen of Australia. Her passing is the death of our sovereign, every bit as much as the passing of the British sovereign, and that's one that's sort of been strongly borne out as a kind of a official view of proceedings. And of course, for a lot of Australians, for a lot of Republican Australians, maybe for a lot of Australians who really just aren't that interested in the monarchy, I think there's been another narrative at play, which is just how relevant is this to all of us, and obviously verging on amongst a lot of Republicans, much more negative and critical view of proceedings. But to see, Anthony Albanese was there along with Justin Trudeau and other representatives, just Jacinda Ardern and other representatives of the Commonwealth, being described as, I think, in the words of the BBC commentator, as leaders from Her Majesty's realms, which I think really did sort of, put a bit of perspective on.
It jarred, didn't it? You sat up at that point.
Well, indeed. It really sort of put us in our place, didn't it?
Can I ask what's going on in Parliament, with our Parliament not sitting for 15 days, even though the Prime Minister has said there'll be some make-up days? What are the implications for the government getting, for example, their ICAC legislation through by the end of the year? Does it matter? Well, is it better to give it time and get it right, or have we hit pause on some pretty critical pieces of legislation?
Well, timing is actually pretty important for that bill, because it's going to go to a Senate inquiry, no matter what. I mean, I suspect the government will refer it itself to a Senate inquiry. Oftentimes legislation goes to the Senate, and if the government doesn't have the majority, which of course is most of the time, then it will get referred to a committee. So I suspect the government will just, automatically refer its federal ICAC bill to a committee. That process is going to take time. It should take time. I mean, we want this bill to be examined pretty comprehensively. We want to know that it's going to be, a proper ICAC, not the kind of half-baked, well, less, quarter-baked, if I can, keep abusing the metaphor, idea of a federal ICAC that Scott Morrison and Christian Porter put forward. We want to know that this is going to be one that is suited to the job. It's going to, not be restricted in terms of what it can investigate, not be restricted in terms of how it can investigate things, not be restricted in terms of what it can recommend. And those questions need to be sort of, do need to be teased out, I think. through a process of examination.
Just on that quickly, Bernardo Follo, the Greens are pushing to expand the jurisdiction of the ICAC to include third parties. What are their chances of getting that included, do we know?
Look, I think that's very problematic because, there are, if you look at state ICACs, they deal with third parties to the extent that they deal with the abuse of public office, and that's entirely appropriate. But I think having a more expansive approach, and the more expansive you make an anti-corruption body, but either in terms of its remit of conduct or in terms of who it can actually investigate, then the more you risk making it too broad and too vague to actually be useful. I mean, it's interesting comparison is the Australian National Audit Office. The Australian National Audit Office can actually pursue third parties that end up spending government money. So potentially that brings, gives it the power to examine not just private companies, but even state and local governments. It tends not to use that power because I think, the Auditor General is aware that once you start down that track, then you really start diluting and diffusing the power that comes from being able to sort of concentrate resources on particular issues. So I think there is a case for actually keeping it somewhat confined, but not in terms of the type of conduct that can be pursued and not in terms of, certainly of, the extent to which both elected and unelected officials can have their conduct scrutinised, no matter what the circumstances.
Bernard, we've only got a couple of more minutes. I'm just wondering, Friday marked 1 year since the announcement of the AUKUS deal. Of course, let's talk about delays. But we still haven't chosen what sort of submarine we want yet. How should one reflect upon this anniversary, do you think?
I think we might end up reflecting on it as one of the most disturbing moments in major Australian policy in recent decades. There is every chance that the consequences of that decision leave us with very big legacy problems in terms of our defence, in terms of the gap that it leaves in our overall defences. Until recently, we could have said it might leave us with a significant problem in our relations with the major Indo-Pacific European country, which is France. I think one of the best things that the Albanese government has done is actually restore the relationship with the Macron government and with France to a reasonably positive state. So we've done well there, but we are left with this persistent issue that there really does look as if there is going to be a major gap in our defences, and it's not clear, despite what Richard Marles keeps on saying, it is really not clear that there are any simple solutions to the fact that we're not going to get these submarines until the 2040s, if at all. And, of course, who's going to build them? We don't even know who's going to build them yet. So all the questions that were on display in that that press conference that Scott Morrison had with Joe Biden and Boris Johnson
back in the
last
day.
Year.
Back in the day.
Bernard Keane. All those questions remain unanswered.
Exactly. Listen, thank you so much. There's Bernard Keane, the political editor of Crikey. Up next, has the war in Ukraine reached a turning point? There have been some stunning developments in the war in Ukraine over the last couple of weeks. After a rapid counteroffensive, Ukrainian forces recaptured huge swathes of land in the country's northeast that had been taken by Russia just a few months earlier. And with this came concerning revelations again about another mass grave, this time in the city of Izium. It's all become a bit of a headache for Vladimir Putin, who's facing growing criticism both at home and abroad while the fighting inches ever closer to Russia's own borders. So has the war reached a turning point and where might it head from here? Joining us for their analysis today are Dr. Nicholas Gvozdev, a Russian-American international relations scholar and professor of national security studies at the US Naval War College, and Mary Ilyushna, a Russia reporter for The Washington Post. Welcome to you both. Nick, can you just start by giving us a quick overview of that remarkable Ukrainian offensive in the northeast of the country? Describe for us briefly what happened.
Well, it's the first time since the Russian invasion that the Ukrainians have not only been able to stay on the defensive, but actually go back on the offensive. They probed, they found weaknesses in the Russian lines. They were able to exploit the fact that the Russians are overstretched. And most importantly for Ukraine's partners in the West, the Ukrainians demonstrated that they can actually make very good use of the security assistance that has been coming into the country since February. They found the weak points, they attacked, they pushed them back, and it also revealed to an extent that Russia and the Russian forces, not only are they overstretched, but there's also a question of motivation. It's well enough when you think you're winning to hold the line, but if you are now faced with a force that has the prospect of inflicting a defeat on you, are you going to stand and hold, or are you going to withdraw? And some of what we saw was not just simply the Ukrainians pushing forward, but also of Russian forces cutting and running or withdrawing away from the front lines, which raises questions about the ability of the Russians to sustain this campaign should the Ukrainians be able to duplicate what they've done in the Kharkiv area in other parts of Ukraine.
As you say, there do seem to be long-standing problems with Russia's forces kind of coming to the surface. Mary, can you tell us more about where Russia's fighters have been coming from and some of the problems they've been facing?
Sure. So Russia sent some of its regular forces because this is considered as a special military operation and it doesn't involve, for example, the conscripted soldiers that have mandatory service of 1 year. But also, Russia faced shortages in manpower from really early on because they have been suffering huge losses even in March, so way in the beginning of the campaign. And they've engaged into something that's called shadow mobilization. So they avoided calling for a general draft because that would be hugely unpopular among Russians because that means, you know, regular people who really don't even want to have to do anything with this war would have to go and fight, which is be very problematic for the Kremlin. So instead, they've launched this really wide recruitment campaign, offering really big salaries, plastering all these, you know, advertisement posters, banners all over Russian cities. They've involved private mercenary companies, which, you know, mercenary service is outlawed in Russia, but it is sort of an open secret that it exists and that is thriving, as we can see. And they've allowed one of the leaders of a private military company, Prigozhin, Yevgeny Prigozhin, who runs the Wagner Group, to go to prisons and recruit convicts to join the fighting in Ukraine. So there's several, you know, efforts to bring people in without officially saying that Russia is at war now. And that has been going on with a very sort of varying degree of success.
That was an extraordinary video that I know you wrote about that visit to the prison and the talk that was, you know, in a very stage-managed way being given to all the prisoners where they were being promised that, you know, if they went to the front line and did their best for 12 months, then they'd all get to go home. And of course, if they die, they die. But maybe it's a better option. And they had, I think, 5 minutes to decide whether or not to join the campaign.
Yes, that's correct. That video is extraordinary. I mean, on so many levels, just some of the bits that Prigozhin's been telling those prisoners is that, you know, if you go to the front line with us and on the day one you say this is not for you and you want to sort of back out, we will shoot you. So he has apparently a license to just get rid of these people without any, you know, this is against like any particular judicial you know, there's no legal mechanism that allows to do that. But he says, like, look, I'll get rid of you if you don't play by the rules. And he's also, you know, offering them, you know, I think it was a 6 months contract. And again, like big salary. He was describing them, you know, what kind of people he's looking for. And he's looking for the most like brazen and brave and violent people who are not scared of killing or dying. And apparently that effort has been quite successful because one of the human rights organizations that is looking into this has estimated that between 7 and 10,000 people have been recruited because the conditions in Russian prison is also, it's a really, you know, violent and scary place. So for a lot of people, that doesn't seem like the worst deal to get out and potentially die than stay in the Russian prison.
Mary, just reflecting on the Ukrainian counteroffensive and the success of that, what can you tell us about the reaction within Russia to these developments, to the extent that they're known? I mean, you say that it sent the typically, I think you called it, the unanimous choir of pro-Kremlin and state propagandist voices into disarray. Where could you see that?
Well, that is stunning in terms of that was quite public because even Russia enjoys multiple hours of TV programming where it's just pundits yelling at each other and, you know, complaining about Ukraine and the West. And it's usually very unanimous in terms of it's anti-Western and Russia's winning and Russia's great. This counteroffensive brought like a lot of chaos to that narrative because for some people, like they couldn't understand why Russia is still calling a special military operation, why it doesn't say it's a war, why it's not mobilizing, because it's clearly not winning. And that goes against the narrative that they have been talking about for months. So they want more aggression from the Kremlin. They want more, tougher. They want Putin to be even tougher than he is now. But there's another group that says, look, this is a bad idea altogether. We should just stop doing this. You know, we should either admit that this is a war and go full out or just try to negotiate peace and leave as we are right now. So to hear that, you know, on Russian state TV is incredible because it's usually very, you know, according to the party line and there's no like step to the left or the right. So that was quite interesting. And also, and a brewing understanding in the cities that are near Ukraine, that border Ukraine, that the war is coming much closer to them. And they're really nervous about this. And they want some sort of help from the Kremlin, from the center. And it's not clear whether that's going to happen. So there are a lot of kind of discontent growing in different areas and groups.
And not only within Russia. I mean, we also saw, Mary, some really interesting reactions on the international stage over the weekend, didn't we?
Oh, yes. Vladimir Putin, last week he went to Uzbekistan for this Shanghai Cooperation Organization meeting, which it's basically Russia, China, and some Central Asian countries. And he, over the course of the past months, has been saying, like, look, this notion that Russia is an international pariah because of the war is not true because we're supported by like billions of people in like India and China and all over the world. But that proved not necessarily be true because when he met face to face with the leaders of India and China, they told him that they are very concerned about this war. And the most stunning sort of public rebuke was from the Indian Prime Minister Modi, who said, this is not the time for war. And like you said, I've told you this many times. And he basically publicly criticized Putin for that. And we have to understand that China and Russia, India and Russia are usually quite friendly and they're very dependent on each other economically. Russia has been selling arms to India. China is its main sort of hope that it's going to become this main big economic partner because Russia is facing, it's under a lot of sanctions, so it's hoping that China will help it out. But it seems like it's not willing to do that because, the war made Russia so toxic.
So, Nick, as we're hearing there, Putin obviously under increasingly pressure at home and abroad. What are his options going forward? There's again been some speculation in recent days about whether he might resort to nuclear weapons as things look more desperate. But in real terms, how likely do you think that would be?
At this point, the risk of nuclear escalation, including the use of tactical weapons, is still very low. The taboo against using such weapons, the type of response it would bring, the risk that it would bring countries that right now are just simply aiding Ukraine more actively into the fight against Russia, I think is something that it's just not worth it. As Maria noted, that as you start to have Russian cities under threat, or if there's an appearance that Ukraine, backed by Western support, is able to strike directly into Russia, that would change the equation. But as we've seen, the Biden administration still is trying to balance that, the requirement of helping Ukraine with not also providing the types of military equipment which would help Ukraine or would give Ukraine the capacity to strike into deep into Russian territory. So I think right now the nuclear risk is still quite low. What we are dealing with, though, and the unknowns as we move forward, is can Ukraine sustain this counteroffensive? Right now, what it appears in the Kharkiv area, that we're beginning to move into a stalemate again, that the Ukrainian offensive has more or less stopped, that the Russian defense lines are firming up. Whether or not Ukraine can launch these types of offensives again in the south against Kherson, further south in the Luhansk area, remains to be seen. So if we're back to some degree of stalemate, then the question is, what do you do to break that? India, China, Turkey under President Erdogan have all been urging that this is the time to restart diplomacy. It's time to start talking. Turkey, of course, brokered the grain deal, which is enabling Ukrainian grain to reach international markets through the Black Sea. Would you have an effort to, in essence, say the Russian effort in Ukraine has failed and now we have a ceasefire and we try to dial things back? But at this point, the Ukrainians, having had the momentum of a successful counteroffensive, may say, look, we're not willing to talk until not just simply the territory occupied since February, but all territory occupied by Russia since 2014 must be evacuated and returned to Ukrainian control before we talk. And that may lead Russia to decide to kind of draw, hold the line, hope that these new recruitment efforts give it enough force to control what they've seized. And then, of course, the Russians are still counting on winter. They're counting on the massive economic disruption that has already been caused by this decoupling of Europe from Russian energy and Russian commodities to really have an impact on the willingness of European allies in particular to sustain the campaign in Ukraine. And so the thinking is for Russia is maybe if we just hang on through the winter, Ukraine doesn't get more military assistance, and then we revisit in the spring our ability to once again pressure Kyiv into either making concessions or for Russia to gain re-control of the territory that it's lost. So right now we have a bunch of different calculations at work. Can the Ukrainians, with Western help, inflict enough damage on the Russians to raise the costs unacceptably for the Kremlin? Will China and India and other partners of Russia increase their pressure for a settlement, or can the Kremlin calculate that it can hold on and wait for high energy prices in Europe to work a degree of disruption that changes the calculus?
Nick, we might come back to that question of kind of continued sustained support from the West. But Mary, have you seen any indications in Russian media of what the plan might be to regain Russia's footing in Ukraine? Are there any kind of serious strategic plans being shared at this point? I mean, I know that there's been, as you mentioned earlier, talk about, you know, calls at least for general mobilisation. That's not sustainable, is it, in terms of, you know, the Russian public?
It's not sustainable in terms of Russian public. It also, a lot of the sort of military correspondents and reporters who have gained quite a bit of publicity over the course of the war and are influencing this kind of thinking about the war, saying this is not going to be useful because there is no motivation among general Russian public to go fight and die in Ukraine, because they don't, you know, they don't really buy into this narrative that this is a war of survival for Russia. That's something that the Kremlin has been saying. So in terms of strategic planning, there's not much going on, because a lot of the concerns about this counteroffensive that they sort of lost and were not able to repel in any way is that there is generally a lack of strategy and planning. And what we've been sort of reporting on, you know, thanks to a lot of the like military experts in both in Russia and abroad, is that because Russia had so many losses throughout the campaign, they had to sort of swap people between units that really disrupted the chain of command. So it's really, really difficult to say now that Russia has some sort of, you know, united force. And that is something where a lot of problems are sort of coming from. So there's really no clear picture of what they're going to do. So far, you know, the Kremlin again said that they're not willing to do general mobilization, which is kind of expected. There were some calls for self-mobilization from the regions, from some leaders of Russian regions, like the ones who are bordering Ukraine, from the Chechen leader Ramzan Kadyrov, who urged every region to send at least 1,000 of fighters. And there are 85 regions in Russia, so he says, look, this will already give you 85,000 people to fight with. So some have supported that, but whether that's going to then turn into this kind of, you know, there's this joke in Russia, it's like mandatory voluntary mandatory thing. So like whether that's going to become something that is presented as volunteer force, but it's actually forcibly conscripted people.
Mary, I mean, you've also been reporting over the weekend about strikes into Russia's border towns. I guess suddenly it becomes much harder for the Kremlin to control the narrative of the war when the war is actually inside Russia's borders, on the edges of its region.
Yes, and there's been a lot of, especially in Belgrade region, which is a really big staging area for the Kharkiv attack, because so many people retreated back to Belgrade and Belgrade border, they're now seeing all these soldiers coming out of Ukraine and saying, like, what happened there and how, like, we're not doing great, that we're losing. And then, you know, again, the winter is approaching and, you know, you could see all these soldiers buy gear and equipment in Belgrade because they don't have anything of their own, like warm clothes and some like gloves and goggles and all these kind of things. So they, you know, start to understand that this is not something that is far away or limited in any way, that this is actually a real conflict that is literally a couple of miles away from them. And they have been, you know, calling on the regional authorities to like cancel school classes in like border towns. There has been some evacuations because some of the buildings have been destroyed. There have been several casualties because very often in Belgrade, especially overnight, you can see like drone strikes or anti-missile systems working because they're either repelling what is coming from Ukraine or, you know, there have been sort of talk that some of what is falling on Belgrade is actually Russian fire, just did not, you know, aim correctly. So there are a lot of concern, especially in that area, that, you know, this might spill over and they're not really ready for that. They don't want war to come home.
Nick, just finally, I mean, we talked about the counteroffensive successes and how, in a way, it was the Ukrainian troops really for the first time showing how effective they can be with the weaponry that they've been supplied by the West. Does that mean now that potentially it's boosted the case for a step up in Western support and that Ukrainian victory might ultimately be guaranteed by that kind of continued support from the West?
The real question here is not whether or not there'll be continued shipments, but at what level. And one of the things you're starting to see some concern expressed is Ukraine taking away weapon stocks that might be needed if there's a crisis, say, over Taiwan? You're starting to see this discussion in the United States in particular of how much can we get our defense industries geared up to feed Ukrainian needs without potentially creating security problems elsewhere in the world should there be a contingency problem over Taiwan or a crisis somewhere else in the world. And I think and this then links back to this question of what are the ultimate aims that the West wants? Is it just simply to help Ukraine return to the pre-February status quo? Is it to help Ukraine regain control over Donbass and Crimea? Is it to help Ukraine be able to significantly change the balance of power vis-a-vis Russia? Because each of those options gets more expensive, gets more in-depth, and the question of is the willingness of the West to support each of those options. And again, right now, in looking at how the Russians have reacted to the counteroffensive, you have some people saying we can do a lot more, or Ukraine can do a lot more with what's already being provided. But at the same time, you're seeing the Ukrainian defense ministry saying, we're very happy for all the support we've gotten, but we really could use now systems like Patriot anti-missile systems, more advanced fighter aircraft, longer range munitions. And I think the debate we're going to see in the West, in Europe, the United States, and other allies is, again, to calibrate the level of support that will be given to Ukraine versus having things ready for dealing with other contingencies.
Nick and Mary, thank you both for bringing us up to date so artfully today. That's Dr. Nicholas Gvozdev, a Russian-American international relations scholar and professor of national security studies at the U.S. Naval War College, and Mary Ilyushina. She's a journalist covering Russia for The Washington Post. Coming up, a crash course in fairy tales. It may have... It may have escaped your attention that the annual conference of the Australian Fairy Tale Society is coming up in Brisbane very soon, in fact, in a couple of weeks' time. I am delighted that two of the conference paper presenters are joining us in real life. Jo Henwood is known as the Ring Maiden of the Australian Fairy Tale Society. Cool title, Jo. She co-founded the society in 2013, and her day job is professional storytelling in schools, museums and like. And Eliane Morel is a singer, actor and writer who has a show in the Sydney Fringe Festival this week called Disenchanted, a cabaret of twisted fairy tales. Together with Alyssa Curtain, Eliane and Jo will be telling the conference about a web series they've made about the origins of fairy tales. And yes, they are, as they sound, very busy fairy people operating across multiple fairy platforms, which is why we're so thrilled to have them with us. Jo, I believe that this fairy tale society that you co-founded may be the only one of its kind in the world?
I think that's true. I mean, certainly if you Google fairy tale society, it's us. We're it. There are a couple of organisations, one in England, a journal in America. There are people who explore fairy tales, but we're the only ones who have it as its main focus, which is quite odd when we're the ones who aren't European. You know, the fairy tales didn't start here, and yet we're the ones who've grasped it and run with it.
I guess maybe in other countries, you know, Ireland has fantastic kind of folkloric and fairy tale traditions. Presumably, maybe there it's just called something else. Maybe it's a folklore society or something.
It may be. I don't want to get too assertive because whenever you say, whenever you're definite, something
yes.
crops up.
Why did you establish it? What made you want to create one?
As a storyteller, I wanted to understand fairy tales deeply enough to be able to retell them personally and with authenticity from where we are, the people we are, the place we are, our history, our culture. So I needed to understand it. And the way I understand is, yes, reading and writing, but it's also talking with other people who see things just a little bit differently from me. And I wanted to provide that opportunity for other people to come together and have that campfire where we spark off each other and have new ways of interpreting and understanding.
Now, you're a ring maiden, as I mentioned earlier, which is about the coolest title of anyone I've ever met, Jo, I've got to say. But
thank you.
What does that mean? What is your job as a ringmaster?
All right. So with the local groups that get together, if you're a storyteller, you get together in story circles. If you're a fairy taler, you get together in fairy rings. And so there are local fairy tale rings in most of the capital cities that are like a book club for fairy tales, but they need material. So I'm the person who, with consultation, works out the five fairy tales that we're going to explore each year, and then I research it and create an enormous bibliography that nobody ever reads, and then I write down all the things that they could have read in it as sort of what I call points to ponder, and nobody ever reads that. And then we go and meet together and I tell them all the things that I have already read, and the stories go out.
You're not the only person to have ever written a bibliography that everyone's ignored. I remember a few of my university lecturers who had done exactly the same thing. But Jo, how do you communicate? Do you do this via Zoom? Do you get together physically?
Yes, all of the above.
Okay.
So like I said, they've got the local fairy tale rings in Sydney.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the ringleader of the Sydney Fairy Tale Ring. and Elian is a
you're
pillar
also of the Sydney ring.
Of the Fritz Sydney.
Yeah. Okay.
And that there's also one in Brisbane, in Illawarra, in Adelaide, and Victoria, and they will get together physically. But because we're a national society with a handful of Northern Hemisphere members as well, we also have the Zoom meetings. And naturally, you won't be surprised to know that we also have a cool name for those. So we don't have Zooms in the Fairy Tale Society.
What do you have? Go and tell me.
A magic mirror.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Because a magic mirror, you can see across vast distances and through the past and the future.
Of course you can.
And this is how we come
And you can
together.
Put different backgrounds in and you can pretend you're in different places. See, it's very magical, isn't
Indeed.
It?
Indeed.
Elian, tell me, you belong to the Sydney Ring, as we were discussing, but as a writer and performer, you'd already gone down a kind of fairy tale path, creating this show, Disenchanted.
Yeah, yes.
Now, that was a few years ago. And then you, am I right in thinking you then discovered that there is a whole world of fairy tailers, I now know the appropriate term, and you kind of found your people.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that is pretty much it. So, yeah, I had decided to do this cabaret about disgruntled fairy tale side characters who want to tell their side of the story.
Oh, wow. So and the characters who get left behind.
The characters who get okay. behind. So I've got Olga, the ugly stepsister, and the Gertie, who's the goose that lays the golden eggs, and the wolf himself, and one of the dead wives of Bluebeard, and I tried to make a frame for it, and in the making of the frame, I discovered this woman called Madame d'Aulnoy, Marie-Catherine Le Jumel de Barneville, Baronesse d'Aulnoy. And she's actually the originator of the literary fairy tale. Right. There was a bunch of women called salonnières, so they were gathering together in salons and they were telling each other folk tales, but really twisting the folk tales around and trying to talk about very important issues for them, but in these cloaked forms as fairy tales.
And when is this happening?
17th century, mid-17th century.
1690s.
1696.
1696 is a prime year.
And primarily in Paris?
Or? Yes, okay. Yes, primarily in Paris.
Until they're banished, but that's another story.
Oh, my gosh, that sounds right. like a fairy tale gone wrong.
So I had started so I wrote this cabaret, and that was the frame story. It was Madame d'Aulnoy, but I didn't really go very deeply into her because I didn't think people were that interested. I know, that's heresy, I know. Anyway, but then I discovered the Fairy Tale Society, got in contact, and I really didn't know what you were. I didn't know what you did or what you were, and anyway, I started coming to the meetings and getting quite deeply into the fairy tales and going, oh, I love these people. They're so creative and so interesting. And it is an enormous amount of fun to sit and dissect a fairy tale, ways that it should be told, ways that we want to tell it today, the things that we like and don't like about it, the intricacies, the Freudian, the Jungian analysis, so it's like a book group except I would say more fun.
Yeah.
Are there snacks?
Oh, yes, always.
Oh, good.
Themed snacks.
Excellent.
Yes, yes.
Elian, do we know fairy tales? Is the shared knowledge of fairy tales still so strong that it works in your play, for example, to pull apart? I mean, you're kind of unthreading, aren't you, the idea of or unravelling the idea of these classic fairy tales.
Yeah.
But doesn't that only really works, doesn't it, if we have a shared knowledge of what the fairy tales are in the first place.
That's true.
Is that still strong enough?
Yes. Oh, I think so. Oh, for sure. Absolutely. I mean, but I specifically chose fairy tales that were very well known.
Right, okay.
So the least well-known story I have is Bluebeard. Which, interestingly enough, is by a man called Charles Perrault, who was one of the salonnières, the male salonnières. He sort of superseded all of the ladies. Yeah, we've got our claws out for him.
Right.
Anyway.
Could we, I don't suppose at this moment, Elian, we could meet some of the characters from your show.
Oui, certainement.
Okay, first of all, tell me who you are. So I can interview you in character if you like.
Of course. Madame d'Aulnoy.
Welcome, madame.
Oh, thank you.
It's very nice to have you on Late Night Live.
Oh, it's wonderful to be here in this sort of little salon.
So have you arrived from 1696, roughly?
Ah oui.
Okay. And what did you do in the salonnière? Oui. Was it a very deliberate task that you would come together and say, right, this is our storytelling, story sharing time? Or was it, you know, were you playing a bit of backgammon on the side?
No, no. It was very much
verbal games.
Yeah, talking little games about fairies and fairy tales, and we would
it was little plays,
and we would best each other. So it has a better story each time. Try and make each other tell better stories. And
I should introduce. This is Joe, Madame.
Joe's
a ring maiden.
Welcome to the salon, Joe.
I have always wished to be part of a salon.
Well, you are tonight.
Welcome.
You are tonight. And who else? I mean, you mentioned some of the other left behind characters, like
yes, I will. I'm just bringing Olga. She is the ugly sister, so-called ugly sister.
Not at all ugly from what I'm seeing. But
no. I am Olga, and people are saying I am ugly Bigfoot stepsister to Cinderella, but actually I am sister to Svetlana. Yeah, and she is, and Cinderella is our stepsister, you see. So there are two sides to every story.
Okay.
So I believe that Cinderella last year has decided to, she went off with Prince Charming, as you all know. He found a little shoe. But she has decided to consciously uncouple from the royal family, actually.
Wow. You know?
And I find this quite ironic.
It's the postscript that was never written down, wasn't it?
No.
Joe, tell me, do you have, I know this is a toughie, but work through it with me. Do you have our favourite or favourite fairy tales?
I have many favourite fairy tales.
What's the one you want to tell us about now?
I will tell you about the 12 Dancing Princesses.
I think I know this one. Yeah. This is one of my favourites.
Oh, good, because it's so little known. And my big regret is that Tchaikovsky didn't turn it into a ballet, because then everyone would know how magnificent it is. So there are these women who are so strong, so powerful, that their father has locked them up. Right? 12 princesses, so locked up every night. And yet, in the morning, their slippers are all worn to pieces. How can this be? Well, their father, the king, who is, you know, a bastion of the patriarchy, as you've probably already gathered, puts out a message to get any man who can find out the secret of these worn-out slippers. And one by one they come, they fail, they get executed, until an old soldier comes along. And he pretends to take the drink they've offered, but is secretly hiding underneath a blanket, an invisibility cloak, if you will, and watches as those 12 princesses dive down, open up a bed and go down into the underworld, a world that is dark and mysterious, full of trees, silver and gold, and they float across the lake to a palace filled with music where they dance with the ghosts of those dead princes. And he follows them back and he comes there and returns with them, and then he dobs them in.
Thank you.
So the way the story finishes up officially is women find a way to escape, and you know, women are suppressed, they find a way to escape. Women are suppressed, and that's the end. Yay, the patriarchy. No, I say to
When's the sequel coming out?
We need a third act, and that's why you need a fairy tale society.
But that's the Grimm brothers, isn't it?
No, that's Perrault.
That was Perrault.
Yeah. Oh, that's Perrault. Yeah.
Naturally.
Oh my gosh, there are strong feelings, listener. Now, if you're getting the sense that there are strong feelings about some of those fairy tales, you are right. You also quite like, Joe, I know you've spoken in the past about an African tale called The Magic Mirror. And it is important, isn't it, to note that a lot of these tales certainly were handed down and derived from many other cultures, Chinese, Indian, African.
Yes, well, when you say Chinese, the oldest Cinderella in the world is Ye Shen, which is a Chinese story, hence the idea that a small foot is a sign of beauty. And the ancestor worship, you know, that gets recycled as the fairy godmother. But what's happening is fairy tales, as originated by our salonniers, are a European construct, and then they get disseminated along those paths of colonisation. But then they meet the indigenous culture or the immigrant culture, and they get transformed. And what step are we on in that path in Australia?
It's an organic development.
Yeah, right. Yes.
I mean, I have a question for you about mermaids. Because I'm finding this controversy over The Little Mermaid very interesting. Are you aware of this, that there has been Disney has brought out a new version of The Little Mermaid. They've cast a black actor in the role of the mermaid. There has been some conservative pushback against the idea that a mermaid could be black. I mean, I would have thought that whether or not mermaids exist might be more of an issue. But I think certainly on social media, it's led to lots of viral videos, and I hate that word, but very popular shared videos of black mums, so African-American, Afro-Caribbean mums, filming their daughters at the moment when they realise that the mermaid looks like them.
Yes.
And it's this astonishing kind of moment of awakening.
Yeah.
Going back to that idea of this is an organic unfolding of shared stories, I'm guessing you aren't troubled by the idea that
I love it.
A mermaid could be black.
No, I love it. I mean, there's, you know that in the top end of Australia there are York that are spirits, water spirits too, and I doubt very much that they look, you know, too bland. They're not pale and stale up there either. So you've got water spirits throughout the world, and if they're water spirits, then shouldn't they look like the water? And if they're in the water, aren't they the reflections of us, of our deepest beings? And therefore, wherever we look out, we see ourselves. And that's what art should do. Art should always be a reflective surface of who we are. And this is why the flat characters of fairy tales work so brilliantly as an art form, because they are so flat that you always see yourself. And that's where the magic lies.
I mean, it's interesting if you think about Santa Claus, I guess, for example. You know, you go to different countries and they celebrate similar traditions, but I lived in the Netherlands for a while, and the traditions around what St. Pete looks like. It's extraordinary. It's completely different to happening across the water in England, for example.
But see, I've heard in America that Santa Claus looks like the family at the bottom of the chimney. So if Santa Claus comes down the chimney of an African-American family, he indeed will be African-American. And if he comes down a Hispanic family, that's what he'll look like. And so whenever you see the magic and the generosity, that's yourself that you're seeing reflected back.
So here we are, unpicking the identity politics of fairy tales on Late Night Live. Thank you so much for joining us, Jo Henwood and Ellie-Anne Morell. Hopefully that inspires you to perhaps establish your own fairy tale ring or find one close by. Enjoy the conference, and thanks so much for your time.
Thank you
for having us.
Ellie-Anne Morell and Jo Henwood, along with Alyssa Curtain, are creating a web series on the origins of fairy tales. They're talking about it at the Australian Fairy Tale Society Conference in Brisbane on the 1st and 2nd of October. And Ellie-Anne's live show, which seems to be a hit with audiences wherever she's done it, it's clocked up a few awards already. It's called Disenchanted, a cabaret of twisted fairy tales, and it's on this week at the Sydney Fringe Festival and heading to Brisbane. On our next show, Bruce Shapiro with the latest on US politics and a special feature, a panel of Australian female foreign correspondents. Don't miss it.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.